WHD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Linda Kenyon. Striking writers may be zeroing in on a deal. CBS's Bradley Blackburn reports.
The stage is set for a potential deal between the Writers Guild of America and the Hollywood studios. Late Saturday, the two sides issued a short joint statement saying they'll meet again.
We're hearing that they're close, but perhaps not as close as some of the press reports, which have suggested that it's all down to the drafting by the lawyers.
Variety and other trade publications report the studios have presented their best and final offer for a new three-year contract. It comes after 4 days of negotiations that reportedly included the heads of Disney, Warner Brothers Discovery, Netflix, and Universal.
They thought they were going to, I think on both sides, stop pretty much they're going to have this over by Thursday.
Bradley Blackburn, CBS News, New York.
Progress in the UAW strike against Ford, but union president Sean Fain says not with GM and Stellantis. President Biden plans to show his support for the striking auto workers with a bold gesture this week.
President Biden showing up to the picket line on Tuesday is a historic event. We have never seen in modern history a president show up to a picket line like this.
The full interview with Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is on CBS's Face the Nation. A NASA spacecraft returns to Earth today after an epic journey. More from BBC science correspondent Rebecca Morell near the planned landing site.
The capsule is heading the Dugway military base in Utah.
The landing date has been set since the mission launched 7 years ago. So after traveling billions of miles through space, the capsule is going to land somewhere over here in the Utah desert.
The spacecraft is carrying soil from the near-Earth asteroid Bennu. Scientists hope it will contain clues about the origin of Earth and life on the planet. President Biden is calling on Republicans to agree to a spending bill to avert a government shutdown. CBS's Tom Foti reports.
With time running out before a possible partial government shutdown next weekend, President Biden says he had a spending deal with Republican leaders, but now...
A small group of extreme Republicans don't want to live up to the deal. So now everyone in America could be forced to pay the price.
That price includes no pay for members of the military and a lapse in food safety inspections. New Jersey Democratic Senator Bob Menendez faces calls to resign following a federal indictment over allegations of bribery. Fellow Democrat Dick Durbin was asked about that on CNN.
Well, keep in mind that these are charges and they have to be proven, and there is a presumption of innocence. How far it goes in terms of his future service is something to be decided by the senator and the people of New Jersey.
Senate rules have already required the senator to step down as chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. This is CBS News.
When you think of hiring, think of Indeed. Their end-to-end hiring system helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all in the same place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
I'm getting back.
Civic Media Radio Stations, providing your news, conversations, and fun you won't find anywhere else.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. New polling suggests most Americans support efforts to boost renewable energy. Local governments say they're doing what they can. Here's Mike Mohn.
The survey data from the Pew Research Center finds that two-thirds of U.S. adults say America should prioritize developing sources like wind and solar over fossil fuels. Madison Mayor Satya Rhodes Conway says at the local level, elected officials are becoming increasingly aware that climate threats are no longer just a future scenario to deal with.
We have to prepare for the impacts that we know are here and are coming. And we have to reduce our emissions so that they don't get worse in the future. And we have to do both of those things at the same time.
The mayor offered those comments in a panel discussion led by the Center for American Progress. She says federal policies such as the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law and the Inflation Reduction Act are helping cities fund climate-friendly projects. But she adds most local governments, especially in smaller towns, still lack key staffing to carry out the work. She notes the infrastructure law is giving Madison more flexibility to gain steam on certain projects.
Both our John Nolan Drive bridges to be safer, more pedestrian and bike friendly with better stormwater management. We also just built a new pedestrian and bike bridge over a critical intersection.
As for other hurdles to clear, the mayor says there's still room for improvement in getting the word out to local residents and businesses about tax incentives to make their own clean energy investments. And lingering supply chain issues are another factor municipalities face in trying to get more of these projects off the ground. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin.
This includes a commitment to news.
Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Welcome back to this, our second hour here of our weekly review, our analysis, our discussion involving you too in the most important news stories in law, in government, and the aspiration for justice in our nation. Always delighted to have your phone calls, your questions, your comments, perspectives at 844-967-2789. You can also go on the Civic Media website. Find your broadcast station, find the Morning Cannolis folder, and send us a text also about your questions or comments. Delighted to have your participation in our program every Saturday morning. And that includes some callers on the line right now. Joe, first from Madison, delighted to have you with us, Joe. Your comment or question today?
Thanks, Jim. Great show, as always. Chock full of information, which is so helpful to get a better picture of things. Wanted to return just briefly to a subject you brought up in the first hour, which was the situation of the Alabama not responding properly to the directions given to it by the Supreme Court to address problems with their voting rights situation and the refusal, basically, to follow the dictates that the Supreme Court had ordered. I'm curious, as a prosecutor, as you look at that, Jim, if there's continued defiance of this, how does that work exactly? I understand with, you know, George Wallace in the integration of schools, he stood on the steps and they employed the federal marshals to ensure that the children got into school. Schools or college students too to be able to get the education they should have access to. But how would this work in terms of ensuring that how would you see this working in terms of ensuring that there is a proper maps drawn and that they accept them and implement them? I mean, would they have to have federal marshals implement them? I'm curious about that. Your reaction to that. Thanks very much, Jim.
Joe, is always a great question, and it's one that I pondered as well as we think, you know, when is this going to end, which is really at the focus of your question. We would certainly hope that if the United States Supreme Court for a second time sometime soon says, no, we're reaffirming our position, you need to have these maps drawn, and they will be drawn now, not by the legislature, but rather by the special master and by the cartographer. They're going to be imposed upon you. And I think, Joe, that's the real crux of your question, right? Now we've got a legislature unhappy with what has happened to this point and no longer in control of the future of this. So the practical question is, how do you enforce that? Let's assume that sometime soon we get the report from the special master reporting back to the Fifth Circuit panel, reporting from the cartographer. Here is the map. Here are the lines that need to be drawn for the 2024 election. This is what will now happen in the state of Alabama. The difference, Joe, I think, between what you appropriately described as our past history, you can have marshals, you can have nationalized law enforcement, quite literally with guns, bringing people into school to ensure that the mandates of the Supreme Court are followed in Brown versus Board of Education. You can do that physically, as uncomfortable and as frankly terrible as it is to do, that we've got to enforce the education principles under the Constitution at the long end of a rifle, if you will. The question here is, let us suppose that the legislature there, they plainly will continue to object to this. What happens? How do you actually enforce this on the ground? Do you have individuals go into the specific offices of the Alabama legislature, the Secretary of State, those people who quite literally put together the ballots, put together the information about how these lines are going to be drawn, and direct the printers to do it? What is the mechanism for accomplishing all of this? We haven't gone down this road before much, if at all. And so we need to see what will happen here. Presumably, even though it would be a great resource intensive to do this, if the Supreme Court says we're doing this, we're reaffirming what the lower court has said, and the map gets issued by the lower court through the cartographer, through the special master, and the Alabama folks, the leaders of Alabama generally, in the executive branch, legislative branch, continue to say we're not doing this. At some point, that's right. That's right. The federal government's then got to get involved, quite literally, I suppose, in going into those specific offices and saying, this is what you will announce. And we're going to change. We're going to print the directives. We're going to describe these maps in the way that the Court of Appeals has said. It raises all kinds of questions about how you would accomplish this. I don't have the answers, just because, again, you would assume that at some point the folks there would say, all right, we have lost this decisively. We still need to follow the law. But what if they say no? What if they say, like George Wallace, we're not doing this at all? Does the court then have the obligation, perhaps through the Department of Justice, as we did back in the 1950s, to compel, through some forced presence in the state of Alabama, the creation of ballots and the creation of maps and the creation of other the other trappings of the upcoming election that are right now not in place? We have to see how this plays out. It underscores, Joe, your great question, the extraordinary nature of this, right? That, again, even though we may not like what the Supreme Court has done on this broadcast and others, we've talked about the things that reasonable people can disagree on and those things that, frankly, reasonable people should all agree on. And sometimes the Supreme Court has run afoul of those commonly understood principles of how our nation should go forward. But we still follow the law. We may not like the decision in Dobbs. We may not like some of the decisions having to do with the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, other things out there with student loan forgiveness, even decisions about admissions into universities. We may like those. We may not like those. But we follow the law because that is the rule of law. That's justice in America. If we've got a state that continues to be violative of that, we are quite literally at a crossroads. No clear understanding about how this would happen. You would hope that reasonable minds would prevail, and finally this would happen. Great question, Joe. Great observation about the impact, depending upon what the Court of Appeals does and what the Supreme Court does, as this matter is still unresolved today. Thank you so much for the call and the comment and the good question there. Mark is also on our line. Mark, your comment or question this morning about any of our topics.
Yeah, and the fake elected things comes into it, as well as the continual, what I would say is, attempt to abridge the rights under the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, that have those votes, our votes actually recognized, because it's guaranteed there that not only the our choice, the voters' choice of electors for President of the United States, but also our choices in terms of our legislative offices, also judicial officers. And the operative phrase, as I see it, is, or in any way, abridged. I don't quite understand the remedies that it proposes for it under the 14th Amendment, Section 2. But reinforcing the 14th Amendment is also, Amendment 15, which guarantees the right based on race or contiguous condition of servitude, the 19th Amendment, which guaranteed women the right to vote, the 24th Amendment, which forbids poll taxes, and the 26th Amendment, which provides, for 18-year-olds to vote, and the continued attempt on the basis of part of our legislature, or the proposals coming out that, for example, one to change so where students would have to vote for their home district, wherever that may be, regardless of the fact they may have actually lived to qualify as an elector, which is a voter, that they've lived in a district for 30 days, and that they should have the right to vote in that particular district. And that I would propose that those these people that actually have come out now and want to impeach not only Judge Protasiewicz, but also to impeach Megan Wolf, are in violation of at least the spirit of the Constitution as given out in both our federal constitution and our state constitution, which recognizes the federal constitution as part of state law.
Right, and certainly the Supremacy Clause does that as well, right? The Constitution, the supreme law of the land, when it comes to disputes, if there are disputes, if there are differences between interpretations at the federal level and the state level, it's the federal government that is the supreme law of the land. The kinds of things you talk about, Mark, very important to understand in all those areas, all those various areas you've described, including impeachment, including this continuing issue about the 14th Amendment and the possibility that that would be a basis upon which to keep the former president off the ballot. We'll talk about that down the road as well. All those things underscore the notion that we send people, whether it's to the State House in Madison, the governor's mansion in Madison, send people to the White House, send people to Congress. Frankly, through the president, we put people on the United States Supreme Court. And here in the state of Wisconsin, we elect our Supreme Court justices like we elect our judges in the appeals courts and the circuit courts as well. What do we contemplate? What do we anticipate from all of those people? We anticipate integrity in the work that they're doing. We anticipate that even in the midst of all the rules and regulations, some of them set forth with great particularity in our Constitution, in the laws we pass under it, both state laws, federal laws. We anticipate also some common sense. We also anticipate that our elected officials, our appointed people, will act in the spirit that you just described, Mark, which is in the best interest of the people of the United States of America, the state of Wisconsin. And when they fail to do that, and when they use these mechanisms and engage in machinations that are simply intended to blow things up, to stop the regular processes of government from working, whether it's impeachments threatened here in the state of Wisconsin, impeachments now threatened, of course, in the federal government as well, with the opening of this inquiry by the House of Representatives into the impeachment of the president, all of these kinds of things, not enforcing the fundamental norms of our nation that contemplate differences among people, that we debate the substance of things, but we anticipate and we expect from our elected officials, our appointed officials, some fundamental adherence to common sense and to the understanding that when the people of our nation, the people of our state have spoken through the elective process, and yes, also through the appointed process as well, that we are giving them the responsibility to do those jobs rationally and thoughtfully, and that the norms that have applied in our nation and in the state of Wisconsin need to continue to apply. The machinations that are out there right now, including again, these things having to do with impeachments, I would offer, as we'll talk in just a few moments as well, that even the machinations about the budget debate going on right now, they're less substantive and more simply intended to disrupt the normal function of government to the detriment of all of us, including, as I'll describe in just a few moments, justice and law in America. All good points to be made as we think about what our elected officials should be, why we send them to office, and what we can reasonably expect from them in this great representative role that they play on our behalf. When we come back, we're going to talk more about some other instances of justice in America, including the testimony by our Attorney General in front of the House Judiciary Committee, and yes, an indictment of a sitting senator just this past week. Stay with us for that continuing discussion.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
My immediate thought when I read about this and then watched it today was, please don't die, Senator McConnell. I couldn't disagree more strongly with Senator McConnell's policy positions, but he has been one of the only elected officials that's in a leadership position for the Republican Party that hasn't completely supplicated himself to Donald Trump.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Weeknights at 6 p.m.
on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Brock.
I didn't realize that Tucker Carlson's like hemorrhaging viewers. And I heard yesterday someone was like, oh yeah, like no one's actually watching it anymore. I was like, oh, yeah, that doesn't really surprise me. It's kind of like Threads.
it was a thing for about 5 minutes.
A week, everyone was excited, and then they moved on.
Wow, it's like Scott Walker's presidential campaign. It's a big deal for about a week.
As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Bry. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
Aaron comes in every day looking like he just stepped out of a Turkish bathhouse because it's so hot in there. Just to recap, so far this segment has been filled with dog vomit, old men peeing, and Aaron wearing a dish towel. So we're...
Hey man, your name's on the show. Your name's on the show.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday morning 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
The Green Bay Packers call Lambeau Field home, but did you know the stadium has a history all its own? It started with where to build it. Residents on both sides of the city wanted it. Officials argued there had to be room for growth. Eventually, farmland was purchased, but in Ashwaubenon. The bargaining continued, and in 1956, the land was annexed to Green Bay. Green Bay City Stadium became a reality the following year and was renamed in honor of team co-founder and coach Curly Lambeau in 1965. For Civic Media, I'm Terry Barr.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. We are your hometown radio, refreshed.
Continuing to engage with me in this discussion of things related to law and government and justice in America. A couple more things on the docket, both here from the broadcast, but also the syllabus of America this past week. The Attorney General of the United States of America, Merrick Garland, appearing before the House Judiciary Committee as a part of its regular oversight. You may wonder, well, gee, how is it that the Attorney General is appearing before the House Committee? We've got two different branches of government, again, the Justice Department inside the executive branch, responsible for the execution of laws, federal laws in America, and appearing before the House Judiciary Committee, including Jim Jordan, the chair of that Judiciary Committee this past week, part of the oversight practice. And again, no one disputes the fact that it is appropriate for the representatives in the House and the Senate, certainly, to from time to time call in representatives of the executive branch, quiz them, ask them questions about how it is that the law is being executed, not just in the area of justice, but in other areas as well. This happens all the time. It's a part of the oversight process of the Congress. Presumably, it's also the predicate for members of Congress to put together individually, as groups, as committee members, legislation that might address particular things that the members of the executive branch may identify for those committees that need change. So we have the Attorney General just this past week appearing before the House Judiciary Committee and talking about things that are important to him, of course, as the chief federal law enforcement officer, but also, of course, things that the committee itself, as they ask him questions, that they want answers to. And here's the point. Most typically, even in situations where you have divided government, which can sometimes be a very good thing, checks and balances across parties can accomplish some good things, necessitating compromises of all kinds out there. Typically, when these oversight hearings happen, specifically with an attorney general, comes there to talk about things like policies for the enforcement of federal law, law enforcement initiatives, civil rights, criminal procedures, all kinds of things, environment, tax issues, antitrust issues, all kinds of things having to do with, once again, the aspiration for justice in America. This past week, the attorney general appearing in front of the House Judiciary Committee, some of that, but not a whole lot of that, candidly, prompting the attorney general in his opening statement, anticipating some of the attacks that he was, in fact, were hurled at him during the course of this presentation, his appearance before the House Judiciary Committee, providing this information to the committee. He reaffirmed, out of necessity, he plainly felt, the notion that, number one, he is not the president's attorney. He does not represent the president of the United States of America. Other people do that both in a private and political setting, and also their attorneys inside the White House who are White House counsel. That is not the role of the attorney general. The attorney general, as we have spoken in great detail, is an arm's length member of the cabinet, certainly appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate, but not responsive and responsible to
the president when it comes to the actual execution of law. That should be arm's length. And decisions made by the attorney general should be independent of the White House itself. That's what Merrick Garland attempted and did affirm with great clarity this past week, saying, I'm not the president's lawyer, nor did he say that he is the prosecutor for the Congress. He's not here to prosecute people. And indeed, as we'll talk in just a moment or so, the Department of Justice continues to prosecute across political lines. And just this past week also indicted a sitting Democratic senator coming out of the very agency, the very entity that Merrick Garland supervises. And so all of that coming out of the review by the House Judiciary Committee of what's going on at the Department of Justice this past week. Along the way, we know that Merrick Garland, he's spent most of his career, 40 years, trying to transcend partisan politics. And that certainly goes back to at least the past 7 years or so, when he has found himself involved in a sort of a succession of political controversies. First, as the Supreme Court candidate, did not get a hearing, did not get a vote in front of the United States Senate. And now as the Attorney General, whose term is plainly going to be defined, at least in major part, by the decision of the special counsel appointed by this attorney general to indict through the grand jury process the former president on two different grounds. That is the Mar-a-Lago case involving the taking, the possession, the ownership of classified and other documents that should not be in the possession of the former president. And second, arguably much more important than that, January 6th. And we'll talk at the end of our hour here this morning more about the indictment in that case having to do with the attempts made by the president. He is the singular defendant in that case. But others, six unindicted co-defendants and people beyond that list too, who attempted to steal the election in 2020 and 2021 and install, continue to have Donald Trump in office when, in fact, Joe Biden had won the election. All of that is going to forever color the tenure of this attorney general. Significantly, there are Republicans out there who did not, in fact, attack the attorney general in the way that others did. One of them is Ken Buck of Colorado. He's a member of the ultra-conservative Freedom Caucus. He did not so-called pile on. He's a former federal prosecutor. He has emerged kind of as a leading Republican. He is a critic of the push to impeach President Biden, which, again, we know is underway. At least an inquiry is underway without any proof of corruption. And Buck actually, during the course of the hearing this past week, listed several examples in Garland's career that demonstrated his independence and the integrity of the attorney general, suggested that no decision Garland makes in the Hunter Biden investigation would satisfy the critics out there. Basically, this is a no-win proposition, he said. He said, you would have been criticized either way. That, again, Representative Ken Buck of Colorado, supporting, if you will, the attorney general, even as others are attacking him during the course of these hearings on Wednesday. Garland himself, plainly combative during the course of this, and not in a position of yelling or screaming, but nonetheless, pushing back on those people who suggested the department is anything other than independent, that it may be partisan and may in fact be the product of some political animus out there. A few seconds during this hearing before the House Judiciary Committee are especially telling on that point. What happened had to do with a statement made by Representative Van Drew of New Jersey. When we come back, I'll tell you more about that and about the response that Merrick Garland made during the course of this hearing of just this past week. Stay with us for that discussion.
Missed your favorite show? It's easy to find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Apple, Google, or civicmedia.us.
CBS News Brief. A deal could be close at hand that would end the Writers Guild strike. Both sides are meeting again today. Entertainment attorney and journalist Jonathan Handel.
We're hearing that they're close, but perhaps not as close as some of the press reports, which have suggested that it's all down to the drafting by the lawyers.
Meanwhile, the strike of the United Auto Workers Union continues with an expansion Friday. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg appeared on CNN.
These auto companies can thrive in a win-win deal that does what the president has called for, which is to say that record profits should lead to record pay and record benefits for the workers who are creating all that value.
A capsule containing the largest chunk of an asteroid ever brought to Earth is scheduled to enter the atmosphere this hour. Astrobiologist Keith Cowing.
You've got this collection of rocks with chemicals on it that could lead to the origin of life on Earth, and also water. Where did our oceans come from?
CBS News Brief, I'm Wendy Gillette.
Buck Tussle has been providing high-speed internet to rural Wisconsin before it was cool. Now we're celebrating the company and the bug that started it all. In honor of our mascot, Buford's birthday, and the anniversary of our company, we are giving new customers free service until 2024, and 5 current customers will win $1,000 each. For more details and to get Buck Tussle internet today, call 877-227-0924. That's 877-227-0924.
Dig out your lederhosen. It's time for Oktoberfest in La Crosse, September 28th through the 30th. 3 days featuring German food and beer, Stein races, barrel rolling, and the best in live music, polka bands. Celebrate the friendliest fest in the Midwest. Oktoberfest in La Crosse, Thursday through Saturday, September 28th to the 30th at the Oktoberfest grounds. Find more information at OktoberfestUSA.com. For Civic Media, I'm Terry Barr.
Talking to your kids about the dangers of vaping can be hard. Getting them to listen to hot gossip is easy. So here's some drama you could share with your kid. Dude, did you hear about Cassie and Jake? No, but did you hear that vaping can cause irreversible lung damage and nicotine affects brain development? Nuh-uh. You don't need to gossip if you want to have an open conversation about vaping. So if you want to get tips on when and how to talk to your kids, visit talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
The Todd Alba Show.
Two kinds of politicians, those who want to be and those who want to do. Tommy Thompson, John McCain, I would put Tony Evers in this category. They're guys who are running because there were things that they wanted to do.
The Todd Alba Show.
Now contrast that to Hillary Clinton, I would argue, or Donald Trump. Sure, there are things they want to do, but ultimately, they are like Scott Walker. They were people who want to be.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Why are interscholastic sports called the last classroom of the day? Because they teach students important life lessons like teamwork, accountability, and perseverance. School sports are so much more than a game. They're about developing the whole person. That's why they're an essential part of every student's education.
Encourage your student to participate in the last classroom of the day. Interscholastic sports in Wisconsin. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
And we are back. This is Morning Cannolis chatting this morning, as we always do, about justice in America, including the appearance by our Attorney General Merrick Garland before the House Judiciary Committee just this past week, pushing back on this notion that the Department of Justice is partisan, is the product by virtue of its indictments, its other actions, and the civil area as well, of any sort of political energy or animus of any kind out there. Merrick Garland saying simply not the case. Merrick Garland also getting in a bit of a tussle with a representative named Jeff Van Drew, who's a New Jersey Democrat turned Republican. And along the way, the representative suggested that the Garland himself may in fact have been involved through the FBI and through the Department of Justice generally in an anti-Catholic campaign. That's what the representative said. And it drew the ire in perhaps an atypical way from Merrick Garland. Garland, who is Jewish, had choked up during his opening statement in recounting his own family's flight from the anti-Semitism that they had experienced in Europe before the Holocaust, shouted back during the course of the hearing, "The idea that someone with my family background would discriminate against any religion is so outrageous, so absurd." And I raise the issue just because it reflects the Attorney General's growing frustration with these relentless attacks seemingly on the department from many, many different quarters, including these very conservative representatives in the Congress. The Attorney General, again, obliged to as a part of this oversight process to respond to questions, but not these kinds of things, not the kinds of ad hominem attacks. Along the way, the Attorney General also noting that some members of Congress have specifically singled out individual career public servants who are doing their jobs, and noting that particularly at a time of increased threats to the safety and the public safety of all of us, including those public servants and their families, that kind of conduct cannot be tolerated. He said this. He said, "We will not be intimidated. We will do our jobs free from outside influence, and we will not back down from defending our democracy." All of that and much more, a part of the presentation and the back and forth between members of the House Judiciary Committee and the Attorney General just this past week or so. We know as well that this week also saw another indictment coming out of the Department of Justice in particular, once again underscoring the very point that Merrick Garland was making before the House committee, and that is that these motivations are not political. They're based upon the law. They're based upon the facts. They're based upon investigations. And yes, judgments made by prosecutors, civil servants mostly, but also, yes, indeed, politically appointed people, including U.S. attorneys and assistant attorneys general and attorneys general themselves, but nonetheless premised upon the notion that you do this, as the Attorney General said, on behalf of the people of America. So what did his Department of Justice do just this past week? They returned through the grand jury process, important to underscore once again, an indictment against sitting Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey. The investigation itself, again, resulting in this grand jury indictment, an indictment against the sitting senator for corruption, among other things, focusing on a luxury car, some gold bars, and an apartment allegedly received by Menendez and his wife. His wife was also indicted along with other people in this case. Specifically, the indictment charges Menendez and his wife with having a corrupt relationship with three New Jersey businessmen. And the indictment accuses Menendez and his wife of accepting hundreds of thousands of dollars of bribes in exchange for using the senator's power and influence to seek to protect and enrich these particular businessmen. The indictment goes on to say this. Those bribes included cash, gold, payments toward a home mortgage, compensation for a low or no-show job, a luxury vehicle, and other things of value. All of that set forth in this indictment. Of course, many of you will recall this is the second time that this particular New Jersey senator has been charged with corruption. 2015 indictment, also by the Department of Justice at that time, also by a Democratic administration, if you will, at the time of Eric Holder's term as the Attorney General, ended a mistrial in 2018 after the jury in that case failed to reach a verdict on all those counts, and a judge acquitted him on some of the charges. Senator Chuck Schumer has announced that Menendez has stepped down as the chair of the powerful Senate Foreign Relations Committee just this morning, announcing a new chair taking that position. But all of this in the wake of these allegations, very serious, coming out of the grand jury, again, this group of 26 people meeting to determine whether there's probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed here. And indeed, as a part of this, there's some interesting parallels, completely different offense conduct, but interesting parallels with the other prosecutions that we know well. In June of last year, federal agents searched Menendez's New Jersey home, and they found some fruits of Menendez's corrupt bribery agreement, as they called it, with these three businessmen. Investigators found over $480,000 in cash, some of that stuffed in envelopes and hidden in clothing, about $70,000 in Menendez's wife's safe deposit box. Also found in the home were $100,000 worth of gold bars provided by some of the co-defendants. All of that as a part of the 2020 search. How does a search warrant come about? Well, once again, you go to a federal magistrate, you go to a federal judge, and you present credible evidence that there indeed is evidence of a crime that happened plainly here, and also then resulted in the return of this grand jury indictment. Senator indicating he's going to fight this indictment and will remain in the United States Senate. An awful lot of people calling for him to resign in the wake of this. We are quick to add once again, we're not at all hesitant to affirm once again that he is presumed innocent of the charges until he's proven guilty. But note once again the bipartisan, nonpartisan, apolitical approach that not only the Attorney General took in responding to questions before the House committee this past week, but by virtue of these indictments against Menendez, against the president's son, Hunter Biden, and certainly against the former president himself. We've got indictments now coming out of the Garland Department of Justice of people on all sides of the political aisle, suggesting once again that the political animus, the political approach is simply not supported by the rules, by the facts, by the things that are coming out of this Department of Justice on a regular basis. Senator Bob Menendez indicted, again, indicted in New York, not in New Jersey, but indicted in New York by this federal grand jury, plainly going to be the focus of a lot of attention in the coming days and weeks and months and perhaps even years as that case either goes to trial or could ultimately be the result of a resolved some way in a plea agreement with the Department of Justice. All of that, again, taking place inside the Department of Justice that is not only prosecuting the son of the current president and a candidate for the presidency, but also prosecuting another candidate for president, also a part of this process. That's what the Department of Justice does. And by that, I mean not going after individuals who are running for office, but identifying and following where the facts take you and what grand juries say happened by virtue of the indictments that they issue. That's the apolitical, nonpartisan, non-biased approach that Merrick Garland was articulating this past week. We see it as these indictments continue to come. I once again hasten to add that all grand jury indictments, all charges, as I've said so often on this broadcast and other places, are human tragedy. They're human tragedy for America by virtue of the compromise, as Mark was indicating earlier, in the loss of integrity of people who have taken on these important roles. Certainly victims who are out there, and even for the individual defendants themselves, all of this human tragedy, not a reason for celebration, but an absolute necessity that prosecutors, state prosecutors, federal prosecutors, local prosecutors respond to instances of crime because of the important deterrence with respect to the individual defendants, but also to the deterrent effect on all of us, stopping all of us from thinking about and pursuing criminal conduct by virtue of the things that are indeed prosecuted out there. That's what the Department of Justice does. That's what Merrick Garland is all about, too. Reminded during the course of his testimony about a former Department of Justice that's also described in the grand jury indictment against the former president. We have spent a lot of time in previous broadcasts talking about the way in which the Department of Justice itself was involved in attempts to undermine our election, set forth in great detail in the middle portion of this indictment, still pending in front of Judge Chutkan, who is a district court judge in the District of Columbia. She obviously having hearings about what's going to happen here. She's scheduled a trial for early next year, engaging with the attorneys on a number of pretrial matters related to the substance and also the process of that indictment, of those charges as they go forward. What are among the other things we've talked about in this indictment? We've talked about the intent established, at least superficially, at least by probable cause in this indictment. We've talked about the knowledge that the indictment speaks to, that the defendant, Donald Trump, had about his loss, that in fact the 2020 election was not stolen from him, the number of people who described that to him and for him with great particularity. We've talked as well about the fake electors, not only in other states like Georgia and Michigan, but also here in Wisconsin, all of those playing a major role in this indictment, significantly noting that none of the fake electors here in Wisconsin, we know that there are about 10 of them altogether, have been the subject of a specifically identified, articulated charge, not in the federal indictment. That charges only Donald Trump. Certainly not in the indictment coming out of Georgia, the Fannie Willis indictment. She has charged some fake electors, but those are all Georgia electors. None of the Wisconsin electors identified, charged to date in any of these proceedings, federal or state at all. What we do know from this indictment, however, is that the
Former President Donald Trump identified in this indictment, singular defendant, many, many other people identified as unindicted co-conspirators, six of them in particular, and others made reference to in support of this overall scheme to try to steal the election in 2021. Among other things set forth in the indictment is this attempt beginning in late December of 2020, the existence of this Department of Justice long before Merrick Garland is there, while a fellow named Jeffrey Rosen is the acting attorney general. He's got a deputy attorney general named Richard Donahue, and they are involved with a lower level supervisor, a manager inside the Department of Justice. His name is Jeffrey Clark. He's in charge of the ENRD, the Environmental Natural Resources Division. He's also in charge of the Civil Division for a while. And last broadcast at the end of our time together, talking and doing some recitation from this indictment about the attempts that Jeffrey Clark was making to do an end run around his bosses, Jeffrey Rosen and Richard Donahue, having discussions with the president directly about a couple of things. He had authored a letter that suggested that indeed there were problems with the election in 2020 in various states, and wanted the Department of Justice to issue this, certainly to Georgia, perhaps another iteration of it to other states out there, wanted the president to likewise endorse this concept, and wanted to use the Department of Justice, that is Jeffrey Clark, as the mechanism for sending this letter to state officials suggesting that their own elections were compromised somehow. And a great pushback, important rule of law pushback by Jeffrey Rosen, by Richard Donahue, who was saying there's nothing to support that, and telling their underling, if you will, Jeffrey Clark responding to, is obliged to respond to his supervisors, Jeff Rosen and Donahue, they telling him that there's no there, and stopping him from issuing this letter, even though he continues to attempt to issue it, has continuing attempts to engage with the president at the time about what the president wants to do, which is to advance this notion that the 2020 election was stolen. A number of times during the course of this indictment, as we talked last time, Jeffrey Clark told by his bosses, you don't talk to the president absent our involvement. You don't do these kinds of things. Stop doing the letter writing. All of that has got to end. And so ultimately what happens is that on the evening of January 3rd, again, this is 2021, the election has taken place before January 6th itself, there is a meeting among the president and initially with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And according to the indictment, they talk about some issues related to security of our nation. And after that, then we have another discussion that's all important to understanding what's going on. Right after this break, we'll talk about that. Stay with us for that discussion as well.
A delicious Honeycrisp, Granny Smith. If you have a favorite apple, now is the time to pick it straight from the source. Did you know Wisconsin has more than 300 apple orchards? Travel Wisconsin recently naming its favorites, including the Oneida National Apple Orchard outside Green Bay, Ferguson's Orchards in Eau Claire, and Apple Holler south of Racine. Many provide tons of family fun in the fall, too. Tire swings, lawn bowling, hay rides, and more. Apple experts suggest if you want to pick yours fresh, do it before the end of October. For Civic Media, I'm
if you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba,
please be done.
Over and over and over and over and over. Then surely you'll check nhtsa.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
Sounds good, honey.
Check today at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
More than 80 million Americans depend on AM radio each month for news, weather, and emergency information. A new bill in Congress would make sure AM radio remains in cars. Because when cell and internet services are down, this free service could be your only lifeline.
Text AM to 52886 and tell Congress to support the AM Radio for Every Vehicle Act.
Message and data rates may apply. You may receive up to 4 messages a month, and you may text STOP to STOP.
This message furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters.
The Cripes Cast with Charlie Behrens.
Today, I am talking to the owner of Funky Fresh Spring Rolls, my friend Truman McGee.
From an environmentally friendly perspective, the fact that it's frozen means that it's not going to waste.
I'm a serial strawberry abuser. If you're a fruit and you're watching this, stay away from me, okay? Do not jump in my shopping cart because I will let you die.
Cripes Cast every Saturday and Sunday at noon across Civic Media and on the Civic Media app.
Thanks for listening to your local Civic Media radio station. Learn more on our website, civicmedia.us.
And we are back in this final segment of Morning Cannolis, and we're doing, as promised before, some specific deeper dives into exactly what this indictment against the former president is coming out of the Jack Smith's counsel's office, but specifically coming out of this grand jury sitting in the District of Columbia. Alleging in 4 different counts, but also an indictment that's talking in nature, giving us the story about what happened both before, during, and after January 6th, describing the intent, the purpose, and the criminal behavior, alleged criminal behavior of the former president in this document. Right before the break, talking about this all-important meeting. It happens on January 3rd, obviously 3 days before the infamous January 6th attack, the insurrection, the riot at the Capitol. What happens on January 3rd? Right after this national security meeting with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Donald Trump moves from that national security briefing to a meeting that the acting attorney general, again, Jeff Rosen, had requested earlier that day. Why? He wanted to talk with the president, as he can, as the chief federal law enforcement officer, to talk about all these machinations being pursued by Jeff Clark, this letter, these attempts to try to influence the conduct of state officials out there. And this meeting on January 3rd in the evening there includes Jeffrey Clark. He brings him along with the acting deputy attorney general and others inside the White House. The Department of Justice's assistant attorney general for legal counsel is there. White House counsel is there. We got a lot of attorneys there, deputy White House counsel and senior advisor, all of that convened in this very significant meeting on January 3rd, revealed in this indictment. What happens there? At the meeting, according to the indictment, Donald Trump expresses great frustration with Jeff Rosen, his acting attorney general, for failing to do anything, according to the indictment, to overturn the election results. Donald Trump is not happy about this. And this group of people apparently discussed Jeffrey Clark's plan to investigate the purported election fraud and to send this proposed letter chock full of misstatements and misrepresentations about how the 2020 election had purportedly been stolen. It was not. Wanted to send that to state officials. And a copy of that letter is circulated among the parties there, including to the president. Here's what happens. Finally, Donald Trump relents in a plan. He had a plan to replace the acting attorney general, Jeff Rosen, with Jeff Clark. He was going to replace Jeff Rosen with Jeff Clark, and he backs off of that plan only when the acting attorney general, Jeff Rosen, says, if you do that, Mr. President, it's going to result in a mass resignation at the Justice Department and of his own White House counsel. White House counsel inside the White House itself will resign. The leadership of the Department of Justice will resign if you do this. And Donald Trump relents. And that event, described in paragraph 84 of the indictment, again, one of the most telling and shocking events described in the grand jury indictment. And there are a lot of them that the people of the United States of America should know about. Again, all of this, a part of the talking indictment. We hasten to add once again that the president is presumed innocent until a petit jury, a trial jury, reviews all of this. That presumably is going to happen in a district court in Washington, D.C. sometime in early next year. But all the stories, nonetheless, all the tales, the accounts, all of these events described in this talking indictment, really describing the intent that the president had, his purpose in putting in place the people who, from his perspective, would advance his important focus, his mission at that time, which really is the core of this indictment, the core of the Jack Smith prosecution now underway, to establish that Donald Trump knew what he was doing
and that his purpose was not indeed to advance the rule of law, to ensure democracy, but simply to remain in power. And how do you do that? You issue letters to state officials that are not true. You put in positions of responsibility and authority people who will articulate and do what you want them to do, even though those purposes are plainly contrary to the facts and the law set forth in great detail in this indictment. We have talked before about the false electors as well, and the specific notion that Wisconsin, among other states, is identified with particularity in this federal indictment. It's also identified in the Georgia indictment. We know as well that the attorney general in the state of Michigan has similarly indicted, has charged in criminal charges there under Michigan law, the fake electors in that state. A programming note about next week. We're going to spend some time next week getting back to that issue related to fake electors. We're going to talk a lot about the statutory bases in Wisconsin law for the prosecution of the fake electors here in our state. We're going to talk about the prosecution authorities here in the state of Wisconsin to do just that, just as the attorney general in Michigan has and the DA in Fulton County has. We're going to talk about the rule of law strategy in doing that. Why would you go ahead and do that if indeed, perhaps, the federal government might be doing the same thing? We're going to chat about the importance of federal and state prosecutions and all the specific trappings of what a prosecution in the state of Wisconsin under Wisconsin law would look like under those statutory authorities. We're going to describe with particularity and describe the importance of that in terms of promoting the rule of law, even as these other cases go ahead in the state of Michigan, in the state of Georgia, and arguably down the road, entirely possible that there could be a discrete subsequent later prosecution of those false electors in the federal court, in Washington, D.C. as well. That a programming note for next week. Before we go, however, today, I want to spend a little bit of time talking about this other issue that is right now gripping America. We know just yesterday that the Speaker of the House of Representatives sent home members of Congress Thursday afternoon after efforts to try to put together a budget, a federal budget for the United States of America failed. Members of the far right of his party plainly presenting an impasse. And by the end of the week, lawmakers identifying with particularity the notion that they would not be able to put this together. They're home this weekend. And although the speaker has scheduled some procedural votes for next Tuesday, it looks more and more likely that within about a week from now, if we do not have a budget in place or an agreement to extend again the continuing resolution that keeps us afloat from budget to budget, if you will, we may have a government shutdown once again. The reason I raise that is because the consequences of that are more than simply government related. They're more than simply things that we talk about in terms of the political realm. I can tell you that during the course of my term as U.S. attorney, when we faced similar shutdowns, it includes a huge amount, necessitates a huge allocation of resources to address who is going to remain in positions of responsibility. And it does indeed compromise the ways in which justice is meted out in our federal courts and in the offices of the executive branch and the judiciary as well. So we'll look forward to talking more about that next week. Tune us back in again next week as we talk more about the consequences of what may happen in a week from now and other issues related to the aspiration for justice in America. Thank you for joining me today. Have a good week, everybody.
If I could be you.
And you could be me.
For just 1 hour.
If you could find a way.
To get inside.
Each other's mind.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
We've all felt left out. And for some, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. brought to you by the Ad Council.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here.
I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Protect your legacy. Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228 Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.